You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is the 21st of September, 2022. We have a few things to do today. I want to talk about the general topic is the buying and selling of Ukraine as a country. Which has been on my mind for many, many years now, long before the Orange Revolution, even. And we're going to deal with that here in a minute. There's been a flurry of very good articles, more obscure ones, unfortunately, that have mirrored my own concerning this problem. And I mean this literally, buying Ukraine and, giving it over to a foreign power or a corporate power. But you know that for a long time, for 15 years, I have been connecting the internal leftist movement, which is now, of course, the official ideology of the regime, the diversity nonsense and all that, to foreign policy. In fact, it's been a thesis of mine for a very long time that the military, the foreign policy establishment, is officially leftist, and one of the most important, outside of the economic reasons, for military interventionism is the destruction of anything that can challenge liberalism. And I have talked about this from the academic point of view, from the military point of view, from the diplomatic point of view. And today, a few hours ago, in fact, I came across a white paper from the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy. It's called Woke Imperium, The Coming Confluence Between Social Justice and Neoconservatism by Christopher Mott, who, without doubt, has come across my material in the past. Now, apparently this is new to him, and his conclusions are trite ones. But he even has his own concept of regime, without, of course, using the term, this nexus between academia, or actually would be among academia, defense contracting, and government agency. So that's, in a way, precisely how I use the word regime. Then he talks about this new academic governmental consensus. But of course, he can't really talk about where it came from, because then he would be accused of conspiracy theories and God forbid, anti-Semitism. That this represents, this foreign policy agenda represents this conception of a universal morality. And it's designed to push global homogeneity by weaponizing both soft and hard power. Soft power being pseudo-cultural, media, even entertainment, methods of control, mental control, hard power being, of course, tanks and weapons and policemen. He talks about, these frauds like Judith Butler, who's just an elite finance hack, who personally, like so many others, have connected official left ideology, no different than in the Soviet Union. In fact, it's far thoroughgoing totalitarianism than the Soviet Union. Soviet Union was very clumsy in how it imposed that on it. Connecting that with foreign policy and military intervention, the concept of the authoritarian being the illiberal force. And then, of course, he mentions the intelligence agencies, where, they are now, of course, officially leftists going after Donald Trump the way that they have. But he also says something that I've said many times. He talks about the overproduction of academics and those in the managerial class, such that the more well-educated or even academic so-called scholars that come out, the less they could think, because there's fewer positions for this huge pool of people to fill. It's overproduced. Therefore, to both get and to maintain those positions, they have to demonstrate through virtual signaling. Now, I've only been saying this exact same thing for 20 years. My book, The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, The Failures of American Military Policy in the Islamic World, which came out, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, deals with the ideological foundation of NATO. And how, again, apart from the economic point of view, we're going to get to that in a minute, there is this liberal versus illiberal, or democratic versus authoritarian mentality that's official. And this is in defense papers, the defense concept from the Pentagon every year, the RAND Corporation, even the personal speeches of generals and admirals. He doesn't mention, of course, the mass purging of the military brass, but clearly that's a part of it. So, as I've said 100 times, the academic field is, there's very few positions open anymore, with thousands and thousands, at least in the humanities and most of the social sciences, PhDs coming out every year. So the only chance they have of getting and keeping a job in any of these so-called soft power fields is by promoting themselves as officially leftist. And it's just very striking how identical it is to the Soviet system. You had to demonstrate, either through party membership or rhetorical, and even any criticism of the system has to be couched in the language of the regime. He talks about the illiberal country, its internal structure being the target of American military intervention. As I've said for 20 years, the countries that the U.S. has railed against are all illiberal. They're all nationalist, whether civic or religious. That's why all of a sudden there's no anti-war movement. There's no anti-nuke movement. This is, you know, this is not accidental. I also talked about General Mark Milley, who actually was the person who brought so-called critical race theory, which I've known for 25 years at least, suddenly is now mainstream, brought that into the military. And then even his own officers said that he's, you know, undermining the unity of the military. And of course he denies this, but this is what happens when you have a purged officer corps. Where at the end of the Obama administration, even the Bush administration, at the very end of the Bush administration, the neocon purge of the Pentagon, you've had hundreds of generals and admirals forcibly retired, and without any reason given. But we know why. And he's talking about the adoption of progressive speech patterns in military academies. The removal, if you recall, the security in Biden's so-called inauguration was purged of anyone who wasn't ideologically on Biden's side. That was mostly in the National Guard forces. All of this, of course, I've brought up in detail over the last 15 years. And to see this guy, you know, of course, citing everyone but me, even though I'm known for this, is frustrating. I have the feeling he came across my book on NATO, and I have so many papers floating around academia.edu and all these other places that it's something I've been harping on for a very long time. I doubt that this is strictly a coincidence. But of course, his conclusions are trite ones. He really can't talk about the origin of this. He could talk about why institutionally they've come together. Because I've spoken about that until I'm blue in the face. And he also refers to this kind of thing as public opinion. No, it's elite opinion, masquerading as public opinion. That all of these, and what he fails to understand is the way the regime operates. He's actually even defined in a few places my conception of the regime. That is to say, the ruling class. You can't just talk about governments anymore. Using this as an excuse for intervention. Well, it's rhetorical. Of course, the economic foundations are the most important. But if this ideology wasn't in their interests, it wouldn't be official. The regime has an official ideology, and you will be purged if you don't adhere to it. In fact, in many cases, at least domestically, ideology is far more important than profit. Because so many of these, especially media companies, are going broke. I mean, the NFL, NASCAR, knew they were going to lose a fortune in promoting this stuff, but they did it anyway. A TV series like This Is Us, who just went off the deep end that way and lost half of their viewers. It doesn't matter. Saturday Night Live, the same thing. Meaning that ideology is far more important. This conformism is far more important than profits. They will lose a fortune. But what he doesn't grasp, as I was going to say, is it's a way that the regime talks to different sectors of the population. So as far as China is concerned, they can go to the neocon, the you know, Republican idiots, and say this is a communist country. You know, we have to engage them in the spirit of Ronald Reagan, or something stupid like that. But to get a full consensus, they have to go to the regime itself. And they have to go to dominant forces, non-Republican forces, especially in government, and say that, well, they're not diverse enough. It's a racial, it's national socialist state, whatever. And there you get a consensus. The same thing for Afghanistan, which I talked about in my book, at least partially concerning Afghanistan and Central Asia, that they went to two sides of the aisle in terms of elected officials, talking about 9/11 to one group and the oppression of women, which is nonsense, to the other group. And that creates this false false consensus. So someone else, and of course he doesn't criticize this, except to say that it may not be in American interests. Well, I don't know what American means here. If it means the ruling class, it most certainly is in their interest. The other thing that he fails to notice is that there's a reason for this ideology being adopted, and that is that it destroys any foundation for real opposition. That to use one group against another, to humiliate whites, to humiliate males, no matter how good or industrious they might be, to destroy fathers and destroy families, what it means is that you'll never have an effective rebel system, a rebel movement, because rebellions are always based on connections, which are far more than economic, but they're ethnic and racial and religious. The most successful ones are. And Europeans still are not thinking in racial terms, despite the fact that race has been rammed down their throats with the violent invasion of the migrants. Feminists are silent as the migrants rape now the almost the exclusive perpetrators of rape throughout Northern Europe. This isn't an accident. To break down any, whatever was remaining, any sense of community in the North is important to impose their cheap labor internationalist regime on the world. Thinking in communal terms is frightening. Any communal, any universal term, racial, ethnic, religious, whatever it is, even the family itself, to break it down. And if that's the case, there is nothing worth fighting for. There is nothing real except what comes in on your screens. So that brings me to the second point here. And again, this is something I came across today, and it's something called the Lugano Declaration. And it's when the elite, the regime itself, met in Lugano, Switzerland, and decreed what the post-war Ukrainian world is going to be. And this, to some extent, is a laboratory experiment for the rest of the world, too. Now, this has been done before with miserable failures and each and every place, but that's not the point. It's failure for whom? It's certainly successful for them, but a failure for everything else. And I want to talk about it only because I want to explain how language is used here. I've had a few people contact me about the manipulation of words, and especially when it comes to these press releases. A declaration is designed, like a press release, to obfuscate the real issues. You know, there's actually academics who take press releases at their word. You imagine how ignorant you have to be. What do they care what people think? The only point of issuing a press release or a declaration like this is to throw the wool over everyone's eyes. But it's how they use language. And this declaration has 7 points. And the first one is partnership. The recovery process is led and driven by Ukraine and conducted in partnership with its international partners. The recovery effort has to be based on sound and ongoing needs assessment process, aligned priorities, joint planning for results, accountability for financial flows, and effective coordination. Now, you read that, there's really 3 ways to take it. The first way is that it's pleasant enough. Doesn't say much, but there's nothing bad about it. The second way is to say it says absolutely nothing. It's designed to confuse. The third way is the way I'm doing it, and the proper way to do it, is that this is a esoteric way of promoting a message. The recovery process led and driven by Ukraine. I don't know what that means. The very fact that elites from all over the world are planning the future here of Ukraine automatically means that Ukraine is not involved. This is purely an international cabal. Sound and ongoing needs assessment. Well, needs for whom? The fact that it's ongoing, and they actually even say that this is a living document, meaning there really are no principles whatsoever. Aligned priorities and joint planning suggest that this is a plan. This is essentially a socialism for the elite. This is music to the ears of oligarchs. But Ukraine will have very little to do with it. The second is reform focus. The recovery process has to contribute to accelerating, deepening, broadening, and achieving Ukraine's reform efforts and resilience in line with Ukraine's European path. Well, assuming we know what a European path is, European path, of course, refers to free trade, oligarchy, and the immigrant invasion. Ukraine has a lot of space to fit more people, since they can't fit in Germany anymore. But the very idea that accelerating, deepening, broadening, and achieving Ukraine's reform efforts. What these terms mean, deepening and broadening especially, is that this is not just an economic matter. This has to be propagandized to each and every individual living there. It implies media control. It implies that this ideology is going to be taught from kindergarten to the nursing home. That reform efforts are even possible. Reform efforts imply that there's a non-corrupt part of society that can then be used to eliminate the corrupt parts. I said the exact same thing in Kosovo and Albania. Problem is, there are no incorrupt elements, at least not that have any power. I've always been sympathetic to the Progressive Socialist Party of Ukraine. Of course, it's been banned recently as a Eurasianist and nationalist group. And I've cited from them and translated many of their things over the years. So this is more about propaganda than anything else. Reform isn't just changing things. It's imposing the woke ideology, as we've already mentioned, on this country. That's what deepening and broadening means. Those are very strange words if it doesn't mean that. Number 3, the recovery process has to be transparent and accountable to the people of Ukraine. The rule of law must be systematically strengthened and corruption eradicated. All funding for recovery needs to be fair and transparent. So now, in this couple of lines here, the word transparency is used 3 times. When Zelensky opened the stock exchange a few weeks ago, he said the exact same thing. Transparency often means, the way it was used initially, was that there are no secret deals. That you can look up investment decisions and everything else online if you want to. That this is available for everyone to look at and judge. Well, of course, we're talking mostly about the private sector here. And we've already been told that you really can't do that. The private sector could do as it pleases. They could censure who they want. They could remove who they want. We'll talk about the new Ukrainian labor law in a minute. We're all unionized, all collective bargaining. Any rights of labor have been eliminated, which was, you know, part of an exchange for support during this war. I'll get to that in a little while, too. But that's not really what transparency is. Transparency is that elites themselves, those doing the investments, that they can judge each other. In other words, this is about class solidarity on the elite levels. The rule of law. Well, coming from where? And for whom? Well, these are the people who decide what the rule of law is. The rule of law by itself is a meaningless term, unless you tell me where the law is coming from and who it benefits. Even something like, and systematically strengthened, meaning this is a socially based idea. This isn't just about government. This isn't just about the economy. I'm not sure how they're defining corruption, except that I have the feeling that people like me will be considered corrupt. Obviously, people like me, Cossacks, Orthodox people, anyone pro-Russian, they're royalists, they're not included in any of this. So the rule of law, it derives from this very cabal that's meeting, or that met back in July in Switzerland. And that leads to number four. The recovery process has to be a whole-of-society effort, rooted in democratic participation by the population, including those displaced or returning from abroad, local self-governance, and effective decentralization. You may have, your ears may have pricked up when you heard returning from abroad. A good portion of the Judaic oligarchs in Ukraine are now in Israel. A handful are in London. Some of the people at this very conference are included in this group of people. They're not talking about, you know, auto mechanics from Cleveland and Ottawa coming back to Ukraine. They're talking about the oligarchs and that very tightly knit Judaic cult, or so-called New Khazaria, is really what they're talking about here. Whole of society. This is the first time I've heard that phrase used. Whole-of-society effort. That automatically means that we are again talking about full ideological uniformity and totalitarianism. And it's really the same. And to oppose that, as we've already said, is the very nature of being illiberal and hence illegitimate. Democratic participation by the population. I'm not sure which population they're talking about. Clearly, huge portions of Ukraine want to be a part of Russia, or at least be very close to Russia, so it can't possibly include them. It probably makes reference to the handful of Western finance and supported media institutions that remain. We talked about public opinion being filtered and magnified by media. So what the media say, what the elites say through their own media, becomes the same as democratic participation or public opinion. Something that opposes this isn't really opinion, it's just Russian propaganda or something like that. And we know democratic automatically means liberal. You cannot be democratic and be illiberal at the same time, according here. So it's like when Mao Zedong used the phrase the people, he was referring to his supporters. He wiped out tens of millions of the people in China. So when he referred to people, he wasn't referring to his enemies. This is a long-standing, esoteric idea in leftist thinking. And, you know, local self-governance and effective decentralization. Well, you can't have a planned economy like this with local self-governance and effective decentralization. I have the feeling this is really a Republican idea where the elites, the oligarchs, are going to be sovereign in their own territories or in their own fields. Either that or it's simply a myth. You can have a centralized all-of-society effort and at the same time have local self-governance and effective decentralization. Five, the recovery process has to facilitate collaboration between national and international actors, including from the private sector, civil society, academia, and local government. Multi-stakeholder is the idea here. This comes straight from the Great Reset. Part of the Great Reset's agenda is the so-called stakeholder economy. In other words, the whole of society is to be propagandized and manipulated or eliminated. This is another definition of regime. National, international actors, private sector, civil society, academia, local government. Notice, of course, churches are not involved here at all. National, international actors, another way of saying that the IMF is going to decide what happens. They've already said this. If the Ukrainian government ever survives, which has zero support from the population, they're going to have to maintain it by force, and that the IMF will, in exchange for any kind of assistance, put the country under the most severe austerity imaginable. And that was being decided at this very conference. So they know they're going to destroy it. And that's this collaboration between national and international actors. They take orders from the IMF, or as you have, you know, even right after 2014, you had foreigners in the cabinet. But this shows the ruling class is going to take over here, not just an economic elite by themselves, not the state by itself. I notice the military isn't mentioned in here either. Western academics, the academic world over there is going to be purged if it hasn't been already. And of course, media has to be purged, although that's actually been done by the U.S. working through its Ukrainian administration. But since the austerity program, which includes the destruction of pensions, the huge lowering of wages, the destruction of anything that an employer doesn't want, police powers granted to corporations, buying up farmland, and this is, we're going to talk about that in a little bit here too, of the literal, you know, foreign buying of Ukrainian farmland and using it for GMO experimentation, personal income tax increases. I think the agreed amount is 66%. Total free trade, of course, and the dismantling of any state institution at all. Land, capital, if it's owned by the state, it will be sold off. And the only people really with money are foreigners. Number six. Here we go. The recovery process has to be inclusive and ensure gender equality and respect for human rights, including economic, cultural, and social rights. Recovery needs to benefit all, and no part of society should be left behind. Disparities need to be reduced. This, you might want to say, is really just the lowest form of rhetoric. People like me who live over there don't have social or cultural rights. The U.S. and these very same people applauded and, in fact, financed the breaking down of any pro-Russian media in the area, or even those who just had a neutrality that wasn't enthusiastic enough for the state and the oligarchs that remain. Recovery needs to benefit all. Well, nothing here is based on any concept of equality. This is a handful of elites meeting in Switzerland, imposing this on the country. So they're not using the word equality in a normal sense. They're not certainly not talking about equity. Now, they tried to do this same thing in Afghanistan, where American finance enterprises had to, including even the government, the colonial government of the U.S. that used to exist, had affirmative action for different racial minorities and women, and the whole thing backfired. You had men who wouldn't cooperate, the Afghan seeing this as cultural imperialism, etc. That's part of the reason why the U.S. lost over there. At most, that's what they're saying here. Of course, I don't know what they mean by the word benefit. Recovery needs to benefit all. Well, if they come to accept liberalism, they're benefited in their minds. No part of society should be left behind of what? Well, that could be ideological as much as it is economic. And you can't be applauding the oligarchic system there for years, for decades, as you had in American academia and elsewhere, and talk about disparities. They will impose the woke ideology on Ukraine, and at least as it sees fit, and the family will come under attack and all the rest of it. And one of the things that they've taken aim at is the fact that Ukrainians, of course, have a healthy reaction to homosexuality, that is to be repulsed by it. And that they've already talked about, they're going to be quote-unquote working on. So this is going to be, media's going to be taken over, universities, schools are going to be taken over, and the economic part of the country controlled by foreigners. So they're simply going to take the Washington consensus, the BlackRock consensus, which includes all of this, and impose it on the country in the name of and that is consistent with their conception of democracy. Finally, the recovery process has to rebuild Ukraine in a sustainable manner aligned with the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and the Paris Agreement, integrating social, economic, and environmental dimensions, including green transition. Well, of all countries that can least afford this kind of extravagance, it's Ukraine. Had Yanukovych back in 2004, had he been left in power, he would have entered into the Eurasian Customs Union. You had a huge market waiting for Ukrainian goods. You had lower taxes, and you even had a 33% decrease in energy costs. On the other hand, the revolution over there that year brought Ukraine to at least partial EU status, even though in no way could they ever have an economy that could fit in the European, but neither did Bulgaria. They did it anyway. So as far as energy is concerned, and you might want to note that in Russian-controlled areas of Ukraine, all bills and debts have been eliminated, whether it be mortgages, whether it be utilities, whether it be energy. In Russian-controlled areas, including the Crimea, the energy costs are about a 10 or 15% of what it is in the rest of the country. And that's also part of the austerity program in the rest of Ukraine, that these are going to continue to go up. And I'm not so sure if this is simply going to be experimentation or this is a place where you can have an educated, cheap labor force that can be used to experiment with these kind of so-called green transitions. And I'm not sure if that certainly doesn't include nuclear power, since that was dismantled the minute Bulgaria came into the European Union. The fact of the matter is, these terms, these press releases, those seven features of the Lugano Declaration, you know, has an esoteric and an exoteric conception. It's all in how they use words. The esoteric idea, at least in these cases, has to do with the use of commonly used words. You know, rule of law, society, democracy, benefit, all the words we talked about before. And if you use them in the normal way that people use them, their connotations in everyday conversation, it sounds halfway decent. Might be naive, might be just cliche mongering, but it's nothing particularly too nasty to recoil from. But that's not how these terms are being used. So they can talk about equity, not bothering to ask equity for whom. And how is that being defined? And so you clearly see the connection between this woke imperium and elite declarations like this. When I talk about the regime, this is who I'm talking about. But regime austerity that will destroy, butcher the economy, as it happened in any place that suffered under austerity. A good portion of Latin America, a good portion of Asia, got even Britain in the 70s. None of these have ever been successful. The Ukrainian economy is almost exclusively based on Western loans and increasing debt. Aid money gets misappropriated, and only a portion of it is used to pay back Western loans. Now, I mentioned when Zelensky opened the NYSE. It wasn't that long ago, actually. And people like Ben Norton, the publication of Multipolarista, which I'm embarrassed to say I've only known about for a few weeks. He came out when he opened the stock exchange. He did it from, you know, symbolically. He wasn't actually physically there. He announced a program of $400 billion American dollars in state sell-offs. He's trying to make virtue out of a necessity. You know, all the weapons, all the aid, all the loans, they're being called in. Maybe not necessarily in direct cash payments, but this is what we're talking about. The austerity is essentially calling in forcing them to return the favor. None of this stuff was free. $400 billion in what is left of state-controlled land and industries. And he declared to the stock exchange, it was September 6th, actually, so just a couple weeks ago, saying that Ukraine is open for business, which, of course, as we all know, means that foreign corporations will simply buy the country. Now, the umbrella organization is Advantage Ukraine. And when he opened the stock exchange, he also published a, or someone under his name, published a an editorial in the Wall Street Journal. AdvantageUkraine.com is a USAID, of course, U.S. government, U.S. soft power controlled program. The Ministry of the Economy is under American control, and they're going to facilitate the dismantling and selling of Ukraine, I mean, literal chunks of the country, to foreign investors. Significantly, of course, Ukraine has a very well-educated population, now with zero labor rights, and a currency that's worthless. Now, this regime hired the British public relations firm WPP to run the marketing operation, of course. And here we have the same thing. In his editorial, just a few months after the Lugano declaration, he uses the exact same type of language. A favorable environment for investment that would make Ukraine the greatest growth opportunity in Europe. Well, I'm not sure what he means by growth. In the U.S., stock dividends, stock buybacks, rents are all included in growth. It's not actually just production. He uses the word transparent three times in one paragraph. Of course, the average American or Ukrainian is not going to be able to see any of this or even be able to interpret it if he did see it. And of course, investment guarantees from the Group of Seven and the European Union, meaning that there'll be insurance attached to any of these investments where they can't be anything but profitable. And if something happens, the Ukrainian government's then on the hook to bail them out. Now, it was in 2014 that they were supposed to have done all of this, revamping the tax system, legal framework. This was supposed to have happened after 2014. So why is this different? Well, this has one purpose, and that is to facilitate the movement of capital from Ukraine to London, Berlin, or Washington. Transparency is used only in the sense of elites working in solidarity to attract foreign investment more easily, as he says. And then he has this fantasy that these favorable conditions, and by that he means foreign control of the country, that's going to create Ukraine as a powerful IT hub. Well, it's fantasy for a bunch of reasons. So many of the very well-educated technicians have already left the country, both heading towards Russia, becoming Russian citizens, or coming to the West. There's nothing there for them. They simply don't have the people anymore. They don't have the infrastructure anymore. And you're not going to be educated in a field that doesn't exist in a country. The chances for this developing, were 15 years ago. Now, I already mentioned that this Swiss Lugano conference put out the very same kind of things that Zelensky said in this editorial, and that I've analyzed in depth in the Lugano Declaration. And I'll repeat again that this is the exact same group that also planned the harsh austerity measures that liberalism requires. Because liberalism requires the dismantling of anything that it doesn't control. Cutting labor laws, free markets, in other words, there is no, and this is the other concept of transparency, that there can be no discrimination between domestic actors and foreign actors. They're considered legal entities identically. Lower tariffs, at least with the West, remove regulation from the industries that remain, and of course, foreign investment is not going to listen to anybody, and of course, selling state-owned enterprises, which is what this all comes down to. In any of the third world success stories, I want to even include in the first world, Hitler's recovery in the 30s, General Chung Hee Park's recovery in South Korea after the Korean War, Taiwan, so many other places. Developed this under an authoritarian system that took advantage of the general homogeneity of the population to create a single state-controlled, not state-run, but state-controlled economic plan. And if done on social nationalist principles, as has been done many times before, Belarus is another example. Even Italy in the early 30s. Franco, after World War II, there's 100 examples here. You could take either a destroyed or third world country and turn it into a first world power. The Iran is an excellent, and it would have been the case in Libya and Iraq too, had and in Syria, had the West not intervened. But under liberalism, the opposite is true. The military tends to focus on domestic production, import substitution, like the Russians are doing, that benefits only domestic producers. Liberal regimes don't make a distinction between domestic and foreign. Well, of course, foreign powers have far more money and far more liquidity, certainly more than their governments do, but a heck of a lot more than the oligarchs do in Ukraine. So they get to decide terms. I said that all of this has already been stated in Switzerland, that these are living documents. In other words, there's really no eternal principles here, except that the rule of law is a rule of law that they make. Now, there's been a few essays out there concerning this sudden shift of Ukrainian grain, of all places, to Africa. Now, there's something strange about this. There's supposed to be a crisis here. I mean, look, the truth is that two or three American states could feed the world if all of their land were used, all the arable land was used and farmed by competent farmers. So, of course, there's no food crisis. There can't be. There may be a food distribution issue. But in Ukraine, where, you know, outside of the black soil regions, there is no fertilizer. These are all based on petroleum. And the infrastructure isn't there to support a crop system anyway. Now, I mentioned before that only a handful of countries have banned the GMO. Russia and Ukraine have banned these organisms. And yet, given that there really is no functional government in Kiev, a huge portion of the black soil region has already been taken by Western corporations who really have no right to be there. This is one of these things that was, you know, Zelensky gets imposed by the U.S. government, and in exchange, he has to do this, despite the fact that he campaigned on the exact opposite. He campaigned on a peace with Russia campaign, if you remember. But you don't get this kind of, you know, billions of aid and grants and assistance and expect it not to be paid back. So Zelensky secretly, which is, by the way, perfectly consistent with his transparency that he talked about just a few weeks ago, made secret agreements with the GMO agribusiness. And they have, and several people have discussed this, they've been secretly taking over the world's most productive farmland, which is the Black Earth area of Ukraine. You know, I mentioned what would have happened had Yanukovych stayed in power in late 2013. The Russians were going to purchase maybe, a substantial portion of Ukrainian state debt. And I already said a 33% reduction in the cost of imported Russian gas. That's what was being offered. And this violence was created by the West to eliminate that. The East held out the best chance of Ukrainian development. Now, one of the things that came out of the revolution in 2014 was the forcible privatization over time of Ukraine's agricultural land, and especially for experimentation on GMO. The ban on GMOs was lifted as soon as Zelensky was elected. And this is part of the austerity movement. So there's going to be another $17 billion IMF loan. But in order to get that, as I mentioned, income taxes have to go up by 70%, 50%, at least 50% increases in gas. And they can't get pensions, assuming they can get pensions at all, only by 75. They're adding over a decade where a worker can actually get pensions, even though the new labor laws say that really the concept of a career is over, which is connected to the Great Reset as well. This is a typical IMF rape of the country. it was only after Yanukovych left that the agribusiness giants, you know, Monsanto and DuPont and Cargill, is one of the first things that, that happened with this, if you remember, arson at Sanyuk. Foreigners, not just in government, but in policymaking bodies itself. And of course, then Vice President Joe Biden was in charge of a lot of this. And any of the Washington approved IMF loans, remember the IMF is just a consortium of banks, part of the payback is that these GMO promoting companies are able to take over Ukrainian farmland. And it's not just a matter of buying it, it's having full police power over it. Now, we talked about that many years ago. But one of the most popular issues in Ukrainian politics is keeping that land from being sold to foreigners. If you have no control over your land, you have no control over your country. Between 80 and 90% of Ukrainians want firm controls over land sales that will not benefit foreign investors. But in the process of this transparency, as the regime talks about, this is being overthrown. Now, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the way that they worked the privatization scheme, those in collective farms were granted their share in the collective farms land. So you had millions of small farmers. And that was about almost 100 million acres worth of the country. The rest were owned by the state. And in the process, GMO was made illegal. So the way that, you know, this is the nature of oligarchic society. Secret deals with Monsanto, Cargill, DuPont, all the rest of them began to illegally use their manipulated seeds in the country. So the way that it worked, even with the law in place, was that these landowners would lease their land to a handful of Judaic oligarchs in New Khazaria. And then they, you know, holding the lease papers in their hand, went to the West and was paid to permit Monsanto and the rest to work on the GMO, especially corn and soybeans in the country. Even the U.S. Department of Agriculture a few years ago fully admitted that almost 90% of their soybean and corn crop was grown illegally. And so for this is really just a fait accompli at this point, is to legalize what has already been taken by the representatives of the same people who put out that stupid press release in July in Switzerland. So, and it's even more than that, it was one of Zelensky's very first acts when he was elected, is to overturn the moratorium. Now, there has been a law against this, despite it being flouted all the time, because the rule of law only benefits one group of people. They aren't really subject to it, despite the fact that the U.S. media had, and even in, just 2 years ago, local media banned any reference to the huge farmer protests against this. So you had the revolution of 2014, then COVID lockdown restrictions, and now the war. All of these have been used as covers to begin this so-called advantage Ukraine idea of, and I don't mean this metaphorically, I mean this quite literally, of selling the country bit by bit to foreign investors in league with New Khazaria. We've talked about what New Khazaria is. And he simply lied about it. Zelensky's not different here, except that he has a lot more opportunity. He has a lot more cover to force all of this through. That there's this huge loophole in the law that he created that actually, you know, DuPont is now called Corteva. DuPont and Dow have created a massive conglomerate, which of course flaunts every antitrust law in America. But of course, the rule of law only affects them, only affects us, not them. Monsanto, I think, has merged with Bayer in Germany. And the only stipulation is that they have to have been operating in Ukraine for 3 years, which of course includes all of them. And even now, even depending on how you read the law, it's very vague, all they have to do is declare, you know, the village government declares what use the land is going to go for. It's called on the amendments of the law code of Ukraine and other legislative acts. It's basically the management system, the deregulation of farmland. All they have to do is say this is now commercial land, not farmland. Then it can be sold off. The minute it's sold off, they declare now it's farmland again. And even the average Ukrainian isn't going to be able to read that in the, you know, it's very esoteric how it's stated. But it gets complicated, but this is how oligarchs function. Oligarchs function by deceit. And this is how, regardless of Zelensky's legal changes, how the West has, the oligarchs have bought up Ukrainian land, despite the fact that he campaigned on the exact opposite. So in order to get these loans, this military equipment, this stuff is not, it has to be paid for, but it's being paid for out of loan money. The portion of loan money that isn't just, you know, doesn't just disappear and end up in someone's pocket. Not to mention, of course, the weaponry is being sold abroad. Anyway, the Ukrainians don't know how to use it. I don't think anyone bothered to, in fact, I know that no one bothered to translate the manuals into Ukrainian. That was the case when China bought the aircraft carrier from Russia, and it was all in Russian. Everything had a manual attached to it. So as it stands, late September 2022, they're calling in these loans. They're saying, okay, we've been supporting you. We want to start seeing a return on our investment. And this is what it is. Russia will then be the only country, only major producer in the world that has banned GMO. This, of course, is also being kept out of the press. This is what happens when oligarchs don't run the country, where the state is more powerful than economic interests. Now, even more significantly, now that state-run enterprises have been sold off, private sector enterprises are long gone. The only thing there now is foreign firms, but they're not profitable at the moment. They're doing everything in dollars regardless. And beyond that, too, the only valuable thing the Ukrainian government has is this land, which they're now parceling out. I mean, technically, you have the old landowners still there. And it doesn't matter anyway, because they can't pay gas and electricity bills regardless. The IMF has demanded huge increases in utilities. Now, the increases in utilities began in 2004 with the CIA so-called Orange Revolution then, which I wrote on in detail, again in 2014, and under the cover of both COVID and the war. So no one can afford anything there. Everything is being done on the black market. Which also means that when this land is sold off, it's going to be way below market value. I think a lot of that makes Ukraine the poorest country in Europe. It used to be Albania and Moldova. I can't imagine anyone being poorer than Albania. I don't know if the heroin trade is included in the GDP. It probably is. That's the only thing that they do. Melting down heroin needles into metal. I don't really know what else they're doing over there. But if Ukraine is now poorer than Albania, this yet again is genocide. And all of this comes down to for the West seeing a return, the regime seeing a return on its investment. And even, you know, the famous scandal with Hunter Biden, that for the most part, even well-meaning Americans, it's too complex for them to grasp. You know, it's what journalists do. They create a gripping, very simple story. They've deliberately not done that in the Burisma, which is a gas company. And a whole bunch of RADA members, there are a few people, I think William Engdahl and a few others have written on this too. Andrei Derkach, Kucherenko, Alexei Kucherenko, Alexander Dubinsky, discovered that the money that was being used by Burisma to pay off these idiots like Hunter Biden in exchange for access to his then vice president father, was stolen in the first place. It's not a shock. The theft comes partially from tax money and partially from this loan money. I've been saying since the early 2000s that the IMF is aware, and private banks and that consortium are aware, that these huge loans will never be seen again, at least in cash form. They're aware that this has been siphoned off. They're aware that weapon systems are being sold. They're aware that the Ukrainian tax base can only supply about 20% of the Ukrainian budget. The rest all comes from Western loans and aid. But of course, that's the whole point here. There are other ways that this can be repaid. So the Burisma scandal back in 2014 was to put well-connected Westerners on the board. And because they have foreign ties, they were less of a target for anyone who was opposed to corruption. Yanukovych being, you know, half and half in that respect. And from this is when Viktor Shulkin, investigating the company, was forced to resign. But the more significant thing is that this money was itself stolen. It had nothing to do with the profitability of Burisma. I mean, to say it was skimmed off is an understatement. And that's Drakonch's discovery. Now, of course, we knew this to begin with, but to have direct proof coming from the legislature itself, including from Zelensky's own party, proves that everything that we thought even a few years ago wasn't bad enough. And it's a money laundering scheme using the John Templeton Fund, or Franklin Templeton Investments is what it is, from the founder, John Templeton Jr. He, of course, is one of the people connected to the, you know, connection of leftism with American foreign policy. But this is how stolen money was laundered. It went, and this is knowingly laundered. There's so much laundered money and drug money in the American stock market that this is the main reason the drug war can't be won. Back in 2008, the collapse of the economy, the only thing that was keeping the laundered money was the only thing keeping the NYSE afloat at the time. And Templeton is connected with the Democratic Party and the neocon movement. And it's about $8 billion in both loan and Ukraine's public money, so to speak. I don't think there really is public money in Ukraine, since actual tax receipts pay only a tiny percent of the Ukrainian budget. Since the military takes up a huge portion of this, this all comes from the West. So the laundered money was then so-called invested back into Ukraine, although not through any productive investment. In fact, the money was used, once it was laundered, to buy domestic government bonds at a scam interest rate. Almost like junk bonds, except that despite the high rate of return, there was no chance of it failing, which means it had to have included plenty of players in the bank. The oligarchs controlled banks, too. So the investment in these government bonds, we're talking almost 20%, at least in Ukrainian currency, was a scam. It was essentially charging a rent. And the only thing ultimately, despite it benefiting the oligarchs to a tremendous degree, and especially that particular group, the debt was raised exponentially. So how does Ukraine pay for these? They take out more IMF loans. Now, none of this, despite all their nonsense about sustainability, none of this is sustainable. There's only $400 billion, probably very overvalued, that's probably a headline figure, of public institutions or public enterprises that could be sold off, and pretty soon the land is going to run out. Then what are they going to do? Well, then they'll simply be abandoned. You know, it's like a whore has a John. The John, you know, pushes her out of the car when he's done. It's the exact same thing here. And as it stands now, about half of the entire budget goes towards paying these debts with very high rates. And it's connected with land privatization. Because the DGB, these bonds, are secured bonds. In other words, if there's no payment, you get to take the only thing with any value, which now is land. So this explains in more detail why the land is being parceled off and given to Monsanto and the rest. This is to pay back these bonds, which come from stolen money and laundered money from the U.S. anyway. It's extremely, extremely unpopular. And because of the war, all labor rights have been suspended. All media that doesn't toe the line has been destroyed. All political parties not controlled by the regime have not just been forced to stop operating, but all their property has been confiscated. But in terms of labor rights, and this again, between COVID and the war, the Ukrainian worker, to the extent that they're, you know, employed at all, means that any contract that they came to work under has been voided. The labor code, which actually some of it goes back to the 80s, has been totally repealed. The law has nothing to do with it. Working conditions, hours, holidays, wages, bonuses, this is entirely in the hands of the employer. Now, they claim that this is a contract idea between in the private sector, but of course, there's no contract between two parties so unequal. They have to simply do what they're told. And they use Russian aggression as the way, what reason this has to be done. But the bill that destroyed the labor code was first introduced in April of 2021. So they were using COVID to impose the Great Reset on the country. And this comes from USAID as well. And the employee, of course, is powerless in the hands of the employer. Now is going to be almost completely completely foreign. So the way it stands, and I'm going to conclude it this way. You want to contrast that to what's happening in Russian controlled areas of Ukraine. Because of the media blackout, it's hard to know who knows what, but there's enough movement of people to suggest that a lot of people know this. That's why the Russian occupation is extremely popular, for the same reason it was very popular in Crimea. There are so many Ukrainians applying for Russian citizenship that he's had to streamline the process of applying. Residents of these oligarch-controlled areas of Ukraine are moving into places like Kherson and Kharkiv, and even the southern parts of the country. And you can only go there illegally because of the nature of the draft, which very few people are actually reporting for. You have a referendum coming up in most Russian-occupied areas, and of course they're going to be going into Russia in huge numbers. So initially, the places coming under Russian control were given a payment of 10,000 rubles, about 1 month pension. Internet service has been restored. Mobile communications have been restored. You have the customs union coming in, including the Chinese, rebuilding neighborhoods and hospitals. The Mariupol, for example, the rebuilding began in June. A huge reconstruction program is the Donbas. Large teams of workers from all over the world, including even North Korea, believe it or not, all over Central Asia, are coming to rebuild these areas. Engineers from all over the world are coming to rebuild these areas. Beyond that, the Russians have canceled all debts, as I said before, gas, electricity, water utilities, bank debts, mortgages, everything canceled. That means that, of course, the Russian occupation is very popular. They're seeing their holdings increase as it is. No sale of farmland to these GMO firms. But that means whatever's left of the paying population in the rest of Ukraine, they're not paying their bills either, assuming the Russians will eventually take over and they won't have to pay. And so you have this contrast. You have the regime that the IMF has imposed in central and western Ukraine, which will turn it now into a fully fourth world country, the equal in status to Ghana or Mali or Niger, places like that. And pure oligarchy, where workers have no rights and they'll drive wages down to the absolute minimum and bring in migrants if they get too uppity about it. On the other hand, the Russian-controlled areas under the social nationalist idea within the customs union, even the Belt and Road, you're talking about a radical two-tiered society in what used to be Ukraine, one where its potential is drawn out and prosperity reigns, like what happened in Crimea or Belarus or even Transnistria, and the oligarch impoverished, exploited GMO landscape of central and western Ukraine. That's what this is about. That's what the war is about. That's what the propaganda is about. And to a great extent, that's what the Great Reset is about. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.